dreams, not nightmares, but dreams. And they were these alternating dreams. He'd have one dream one night and another dream the next night. The following night he'd have the same dream as the first night and then repeat the cycle over and over. So he decided he was going to go to his doctor to see if there was something that his doctor could tell him about these reoccurring dreams. And the doctor said, "Well, please, tell me about these dreams. What are you dreaming? Maybe I can help you understand a little bit of what's going on here." And the man began describing his dreams. He says, "On Monday, I will go to bed. I will fall asleep, and I will dream that I am a wigwam." He said, "Okay, I can understand that. Now, what happens the following night?" He says, "On Tuesday, I will lie down, and I will go to sleep, and I will dream that I am a teepee." He says, "Doctor, this makes no sense to me. What is wrong?" And the doctor says, okay, it's okay. I believe I know the problem. You're too tense." Yeah. Terrible. Well, please, before you direct any bad, comments towards me, today's humor is brought to you by Miss Leah Hoyard. And it seems to fit this outdoor wilderness kind of theme that we are beginning today as we start our Lenten series. And Lent is a period of 40 days leading up to Easter Sunday. And I'm glad that we're following this Lenten series that our denomination puts out. Whoops, wrong button. It puts out, it's called Encountering God. What have we witnessed? So for the next number of weeks, we will be asking these questions of our encountering God. What have we witnessed? And I really like the way that our writers of this lectionary text, they write it out here, Lenten series, the way they discern what this title really means. Because they're asking the kinds of questions that I really like to ask. They're asking, what does it mean that we have an encountering God? Does that mean that God encounters us? Is this an attribute of God? Or is this us encountering the living God? And what does it mean to witness? Is this something that we see with our eyes or something we share verbally and with our bodies? So over the next few weeks, we will be looking at this encountering God and asking the question, what have we witnessed? Now, I know that many people here probably have never really observed Lent. Am I right? Have you, any of you never really even, anybody never heard of Lent? You've heard of Lent, right? This is not new. Okay. Lent is a Gaelic word that simply means spring. If you go into different traditions, they will call it different things. I believe the Catholic Church will sometimes refer to Lent as the Quadragesimo or something like that. It's Latin for 40. And Lent is simply the 40 days before Easter. And the reason we look at 40 days specifically is because of that text from Matthew where Jesus went into the wilderness where he fasted and prayed for 40 days. So the church said, well, hey, if Jesus did this as a time of preparation for his ministry, maybe there would be some value in us also stepping back from our lives, from the busyness of it all, and taking some time to reflect in our preparation for the ministry that God has for us. Now, when people hear the word Lent, what is the first thing that you think of? You probably think of giving something up, right? Many people think that because you are observing Lent, that you must give something up for 40 days. And I think that this is a helpful practice for many of us. I myself have given up things a number of times for Lent. A couple of years ago, I gave up sweets for Lent. And if you know me, you know that's not easy. I gave up Facebook for Lent a couple of years ago. Also not an easy thing to do. I chose one day during Lent every week to fast. Actually, for about 30 hours, I chose not to eat. And we base this upon Jesus' decision to go into the wilderness to fast and pray for 40 days. But I just want to note that nowhere in the Bible does it say you have to give up something for 40 days. It simply says Jesus did this for 40 days. Now, many people like to do the second option. Many people will add something to their lives for 40 days. This is a way of just bringing a new practice into their life to hopefully bring them to a closer relationship with God and with their fellow human beings. For instance, some people will spend an extra half an hour reading Scripture every day. Some people have made the decision that they want to go on these prayer walks every day. I love this idea. People will just go out into the world, outside, out of doors, and walk and experience the beauty of God's creation. And as they walk, pray and try to become closer and closer to God. Lent is also a time when many people have made the decision to give more of their income to those in need. There is more almsgiving during the period of Lent. So I really like the idea of not only giving something up, but adding something during these 40 days. But ultimately, the thing about Lent that I want to lift out here is that this is meant to be a time of preparation. That's the main goal here. It is to prepare us for a new encounter with God, a fresh encounter through new eyes, with new hands and new senses among us. A new understanding of who God is. You see, in the early church, before things got so systematic and so well developed, I guess you might say, in the church, back in the old days, in the first century, the early years of the church, a new believer would be baptized on Easter Sunday. That's the only time throughout the year that they had baptismal services. So if people joined the church, they would be baptized on Easter Sunday. And Lent, the 40 days before that, was seen as a time of intense study and intense preparation to get somebody ready for this new part of their life. So as we begin our series on encountering God and sharing our witness to the world around us, I hope that we can see this time, these 40 days, not just as time to give up something, because let's be honest, that's not exciting. And not just a time to add something, even though that's a really good thing, but this is all about preparation. Preparation for this new encounter with the God that we've come to worship through Jesus Christ. So before we get to today's text, I want to practice my New Year's resolution. And for those of you that aren't aware of what my New Year's resolution is, my New Year's resolution is to remind you of God's love each and every Sunday, because so much of the world around us wants to tell us otherwise. So much of the world wants to tell us why we're not good enough, not smart enough, not loved enough. So if only for 1 hour each week, I want to make sure you know that you are loved. So I adapt the words that God spoke from the heavens to Jesus at his baptism. And you're going to see just how appropriate this is in today's text. So without further ado, may I remind you that Stanton Mennonite Church, you are God's children, his beloved, and with you, God is well pleased. It's an important thing to remember today because we are talking about a difficult subject. We are talking about something that maybe makes many of us uncomfortable, although it's very easy to do, because today we are talking about temptation. Oh, man. It makes us uncomfortable, but yet we're very comfortable with being tempted. It's so easy to be tempted, right? I go home and there's... Confession is good for the soul. I went home yesterday after doing some work. I was gone most of the day. I went home and my wife and children, they're out of town. They're visiting Sonia's sister in Northern Virginia. And I go into my house and there's this Tupperware container filled with chocolate chip cookies in our freezer. Is that not the quintessential temptation right there? The cookie jar. The proverbial cookie jar. And you know what? That cookie jar is a little less full today. Or actually empty. Anyways, so temptation. We know what that's about. We all experience temptation. And some temptations, I guess, it might be okay to be tempted. I'm tempted to give more money to the poor. I'm tempted to... No, we don't use temptation in that way. Temptation is something that we know we shouldn't do, but yet we're drawn to it anyways. We are drawn to do the things that we know we should not do. So we look at temptation today, and we need to start with this passage from the Old Testament, which seems to be the first temptation, this temptation of Adam and Eve by the serpent. And we know that God placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, where everything was ideal. Things were perfect. There was no hunger. If you were hungry, what did you do? There's a piece of fruit. You pluck it. You eat it. You're happy. You're full. There was no pain. There was no suffering. There was no death. People didn't die in the Garden of Eden. People were well rested. They didn't have this thing called daylight savings time that they had to wrestle with every year and ask the question, why do we do this? Because it doesn't add any more time to the day. They didn't have to deal with that. Life was perfect. So they were hungry. They ate fruit. Except with one exception. God had told Adam and Eve, He said, you may eat of any tree except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He didn't really give them a reason why. But He said, if you eat of this fruit, you will die. Well, along comes a serpent. And the serpent is crafty, the Bible tells us. And the serpent says, well, did God tell you you can't eat the fruit of the tree? Really? I mean, look at this fruit. It's good fruit. It's good for eating. It's going to be a crunchy apple. It's going to be nourishing and give you some fulfillment and give you energy for your daily activities. Did God say if you eat that, you will die? Are you kidding me? Apples are healthy. An apple a day keeps the... I'm sure the serpent said that, right? He said, you will not die. Instead, your eyes will be opened. And you will see things as God sees them. You will know good from evil. And Adam and Eve, they listened to the serpent. And they took that fruit and they ate it. Now here's a challenging observation. That serpent didn't really technically lie. Because Adam and Eve, they didn't die at that moment when they ate of that fruit, did they? No, they lived for a while. So, you know, he might be stretching the truth a little bit. But he didn't lie. And indeed, their eyes were open in a new way. But this serpent was twisting the truth and made it just believable enough that they could convince themselves, Adam and Eve could convince themselves that it was okay to disobey this very direct order from God. And they chose to follow a different voice. Now, that's the bad news. But we find good news in the gospel reading for today. Because in the gospel reading, we are introduced to this Jesus guy. And the Apostle Paul tells us in the book of Romans that while there was this first Adam that came and made these mistakes, who sinned and fell short of God's ideal, along came a second Adam who lived up to God's expectations. And we know that this second Adam is Jesus. Now, Jesus is coming straight from his baptism, and he goes out into the wilderness where the text tells us he is fasting and praying for 40 days and 40 nights. So the guy's going to be hungry, right? The longest I've gone without food is probably 30, 40 hours. I don't think I've gone 48 hours. That's not who I am. I'm going to guess many of you have not gone much more than 40 hours, let alone 40 days. So you've got to imagine this guy is famished. He's probably hallucinating. He's probably having all sorts of problems staying focused. And along comes the tempter. And the tempter says, hey, look, this rock looks kind of like a loaf of bread. You know what? Why don't you just make it into a loaf of bread? Why don't you just make this something you can eat? Now, obviously, we all know, because we're good Christians, that turning rocks into bread is a sin, right? Sinner! How many of you have done that before? How many of you turned rocks into bread? You're a sinner, and confession again, it's good for the soul. I mean, obviously, this is a problem for Jesus. He can't turn a rock into bread, or if he did, he would be committing one of the most terrible and heinous acts ever known to mankind. Later, we'll find out it's okay to turn bread into more bread, right? Jesus takes the loaves and the fishes and he makes that into more loaves and fishes. We even find that he turns water into wine. So this transmorphification, this changing of these objects, I mean, obviously that's not the problem. It wouldn't have been a problem for Jesus to turn bread or a stone into bread. That in and of itself is not a sin. And Jesus quotes a passage of Scripture. He says, man does not live by bread alone, But that doesn't really say anything about turning a stone into bread being a sin. No, what was the temptation here? I think to understand why this was a temptation, we need to look at verse 3 from that gospel text. And verse 3 says, "The tempter came to him and said, 'If you are the Son of God.'" I don't even need to finish that verse. The tempter said, "If you are the Son of God." That's how he led off in verse 3 and then again in verse 6. The tempter sees this disheveled, bearded, grungy man looking hungry, looking sick, looking like he's losing it because he hasn't eaten for 40 days. And he just says, "You know what? If you are really who you claim to be, if you are really who these people are saying you are, just do this small thing. I mean, we know it's within your capabilities if you are that person, but you know what? If you're not the Son of God, then I guess just go on being hungry." And the tempter makes Jesus question his own identity. And I think the thing we need to remember is we need to look at this in context. Because if you go back one more chapter to the very last verse of chapter 3, guess what we find? It's that verse I've been quoting each and every week, paraphrasing each and every week. Matthew 3:17, "And a voice from heaven said, 'This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased.'" Just 3 verses later, the tempter says, "If you are the Son of God, you can do this." Jesus is being made to question his own sonship, his own identity. He is being made to question his role as God's beloved Son. Adam and Eve were presented with a commandment from God, and they heard a counter argument from the serpent, and they chose to follow the serpent. Jesus heard a voice from heaven claim him as God's own Son, and he heard a counter argument from the tempter, and Jesus chose to listen to God. Now, I find it interesting as we read through these texts to note the different words that are used for the tempter. And help me out here. When we read through Genesis, what is the word that is used in that passage that Marlene read for us to refer to the tempter? What is the word? I heard some wrong answers and I heard one right answer. The word is serpent. Genesis does not refer to the tempter as Satan. It comes along later in the book of Job. But in that passage, this tempter is simply called the serpent. Now, when we come to the New Testament passage, when we read in Matthew chapter 4, how is the tempter referred to? There's at least 3 different ways. Guesses? Satan is used there, the devil, and the one that I've been using, the tempter. The tempter, the devil, the Satan, or Satan. So these are 4 different ways that the tempter is referred to. And I've been told that there's over 20 different ways that Satan is referred to. Now, free for all. What words do you hear in the Bible? What do you read? How is he referred to in the text? Names. Beelzebub. The enemy. Fallen star, what's he called? Lucifer. Here's just a few that I thought of. Beelzebub, Lucifer, the father of lies, the king of the air. There are 20 different words used to describe this force that is contrary to God's will. Now, I have said many times here in church services that I maybe don't choose to use certain words because I think they do us a disservice. I think that our society has misunderstood the forces of evil and we have anthropomorphized evil to a point that it's not really helpful. We make evil into this little red devil with the horns and the pitchfork, and that's not scary to me. And it's, you know, that's what kids dress up as for Halloween. Or when we talk about, you know, the devil made me do it, and everybody has a good laugh. But yet I think that there's something, I know that there's something in our world that acts contrary to God's love. There's something tempting us to do things different than what we know is right. And I don't care what you call it, whether it is the tempter, the devil, Satan, or Beelzebub, the language that we use probably doesn't matter that much. But evil does exist. Temptation does exist. And temptation can keep us from accepting our beloved status in Jesus Christ. Now, many of you will know who this guy is. You might not know his name from the picture, but if I say his name, you'll know who he is. Any guesses? That is Martin Luther. Martin Luther is one of the greatest reformers. He's the one that kind of cleaned up and nuanced the language of salvation by grace through faith. He helped us to come to a better understanding of how God wants to grant us forgiveness and love. And all we have to do is accept that free gift. Martin Luther is the one we credit for that. He was a brilliant man. Wrote volumes and volumes of books. He was trained as a lawyer and then went on to be a monk. And it was during his time as a monk that he found this new understanding of salvation by grace through faith. Just a brilliant mind. I can't say it any other way. I'll say it again, though. He's brilliant, okay? He was also a bit of a jerk. There is a website on the internet that you can look up. You can get these quotes from Martin Luther where he calls people names. He's like, you stupid sow, and things like that. It's kind of fun, not necessarily churchy, but look it up sometimes. It's called like the Luther Insult or something like that. But Martin Luther was also a very troubled person, as brilliant as he was, because he always questioned his own status as God's beloved. He was always asking himself, you know, one of the things that brilliant people are tormented with is too many questions that can't be answered. And he tormented himself with these questions that he could not simply come up with an answer for. He wondered things like, if I commit a sin, if I do something, if I sin against my neighbor or against my God, and I die on the way to confession, will I go to heaven? What if I sin and I don't even realize it? I do something inadvertently and then I pass away. What will God do with my soul? These are the kinds of things that drove Martin Luther, almost crazy. I think it's one of the things that drove him actually to come up with this idea of salvation by grace through faith. But it troubled him. And not only before he came up with that understanding of salvation, but also after. So as Martin Luther, as he was working in a private castle one time, you see, at this point during the Reformation, the Bible was only available to those who were highly educated in Latin and Greek. If you couldn't speak those languages, you couldn't read the Bible. It wasn't in what they call the common vernacular. But Luther saw that that was a problem, and he started translating the Greek New Testament into German. So as Luther was spending day and night trying to translate from Greek to German, he found himself tempted to just give up. Tempted to just throw it all away because he didn't think that he was good enough. He didn't think that he was loved enough. He didn't think that he had the mental ability to do these things. He didn't think he was the one that should be leading this Reformation. So when he had all of these challenging thoughts, all of these temptations, to just throw it all away, to quit and go back and be a quiet monk in a quiet monastery somewhere all alone, he would yell out in the middle of the night in his angriest German voice, he would say, "Ich bin getauft." There's no happy way to speak in German, is there? It just always sounds angry. "Ich bin getauft." Every time this temptation came to him to just quit and throw it all away, "Ich bin getauft." And there are reports that Luther would take these ink pots. You know, the old days they had these quills that they wrote with. He'd dip his quill in the ink pot and write. There are reports that he would take his ink pot and throw it against the wall and yell, "Ich bin getauft." Over and over again. "I am baptized. Ich bin getauft. I am baptized." This is the way he fought that temptation to just give in. And it's not that he's saying because he was baptized as an infant that he was somehow free from temptation. He's not saying that, you know, one day I'll be baptized and all these temptations will go away. He's saying, "I am baptized," as in, I am a part of something bigger than myself. I belong to somebody. Like Leah sang for us this morning, I belong to God and God belongs to me. Because at my baptism, it was a marriage between me and my God. This is not just me going at it all by myself. No, Ich bin getauft. I am a part of God's beloved family. When we are tempted, when we are feeling like we need to throw in the towel and we feel like we need to quit and just go and do something else, go live on a mountain by ourselves and mind our own business and let the world go to hell in a handbasket or whatever, remember, Ike Ben Gatoff. Say it with me. Ike Ben Gatoff. May it be so. Amen.